candidates for the University of Dublin Shannon d'Éireann election. Ballots for the forthcoming election to the Shannon d'Éireann will be issued on Monday, the 30th of December. So they have been issued a long time ago. I'm reading this, obviously. And the poll will close on Wednesday, the 29th of January at 11 a.m. So there's a lot of candidates out there are very worried, and some will be very happy. Some will be very positive about the whole thing, thinking they're going to get elected. But it is a tough one. And I've never really understood how the elections work. So I'm going to find out in a few minutes, because it is a little bit more complicated than your standard general election where the general public gets to vote. You don't generally get to vote. There's about 70 to 80,000 people out there who will get to vote, but you won't, probably. But some of you might have a vote. If you have, if you're an academic, you may get an opportunity to vote in the elections. And it is really, really important. We'll find out in a second why. Derek Byrne is one of those candidates. He's an academic and a journalist working and living in Dublin. He's over 20 years experience working with the community in the voluntary sector. Derek also teaches on addiction studies. He's also in the Department of Adult and Community Education at Maynooth University and is an experienced journalist and broadcaster. And he's running. He's decided to put himself forward. And by the way, I've always got a lot of admiration for people who put themselves forward for election. I did it myself in the European elections. Sadly, I wasn't that successful. Well, I nearly was. I get into the last count, the 19 count, which was something for somebody who'd never ran before, was reasonably successful. But Derek has put himself forward. Derek, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Noel. Thanks a million. It's always great to be on your show.
Derek, why did you put yourself forward, by the way? This is something you've never ventured into politics in your life before. So why did you put yourself forward? A good salary, apart from anything else. Why did you put yourself forward?
Well, actually, I did run in 2020,
okay.
The general election in 2020, and that was very much for me sort of a learning experience, a fact-finding mission. I decided back in 2017 that I wanted to run for the Senate. I was working as the manager of a community radio station, Phoenix FM, at the time.
I remember
and,
that, yeah.
We had done
yeah.
some really great work on general elections and local elections, and I kind of, as a journalist, I found that, particularly my work in the Irish Times, I found that I had a great audience for discussing the issues that I felt were very important in Irish society. And that platform helped me to kind of delve deeper into issues relating to equality, LGBT issues, domestic violence, drug and alcohol policy. That meant that I could get these things on the table and get a conversation going. And I thought, you know what? Why not take that to the next level? Why not be in a position where I can actually be involved in taking action on these issues? And that's what
You're no stranger to a little bit of controversy and having an opinion, because on numerous occasions I've called on you for both radio and the podcast to come on as a guest. And no matter what the issue happens to be, you tend to have an opinion on it. So you're no stranger to having an opinion. Some of those opinions popular, some a little bit unpopular. But of course, sometimes you have to make unpopular decisions to do the right thing, don't you?
Yeah, but that's the point. That's one of the reasons why I think that I should be running. And I think obviously one of the reasons why I think people should vote for me, because I'm not afraid to kind of stand up for something or discuss something or put myself on the line when an issue is maybe difficult or even unpopular. Because for me, authenticity is key. I have to be. I have to really feel something. I have to really believe the opinion that I put forward. Because if you don't, you're going to be.
Oh, no, I know that feeling. I know that feeling. I was the same when I was running. I mean, some of the things I said may have been unpopular with some people, but I believe.
I think you did very well. You know, I actually think you did incredibly well. And you nearly got there for somebody who's entered.
Yeah, if it wasn't for Aaron O'Riordan, you know.
That's the thing, Niall. I think people are fed up with politicians, you know, saying something just for the sake of being popular. What they're looking for is people who will actually stand up for what they believe in, even when it isn't popular, even when it is difficult. And you know, I've got a track record for that. So people know when I say that I actually mean it, because they've seen me do it before. I mean, I was once called for my views on LGBT issues. I was once called the most hated gay in the village.
You know, right, so you're a homophobe as well.
As
a gay man, you were a homophobe.
I mean, it's crazy, you know. But I think what people are responding to now is they feel that they can trust somebody who will say it as it is, and somebody who just speaks to them with, like I say, authenticity and truth.
But the Shannon, there's been arguments about the Shannon. We even ended up having a referendum going back some years ago where it just barely just made it back in again. But they were going to close it at one stage. Some people will argue the Shannon is just a place for kind of washed up politicians or politicians who ran the general election but failed miserably and didn't get in. In other words, it gives them another opportunity to get a salary. That's the way it's kind of seen by people, isn't it?
It's a shame, actually. It gets in a really bad press. I mean, to be honest with you, I really do believe in the Shannon. I think that we need a second house in this country. We need to be able
And
to
what's the
hold
purpose for people
people.
listening? What is the purpose of the shadow?
Well,
Because we see people things. I mean, let me give you an example. The hate speech laws, right? Were debated in the Senate. And then they went back to the Dáil, and of course they went through, right? Now, they haven't come in yet, thankfully, and I know they're going to amend them and stuff like that, and I'll come back to that later on in the conversation, because obviously if you do get in, you'll have an opportunity to talk on it again. But no matter what is said in the debates in the Senate, there were some great arguments put across by Michael McDougall and Sharon Keoghan and a few others, Rona Mullen, and a few, but it doesn't seem to make any difference in the Dáil. They still seem to vote the same way. So does it really make a difference?
Yes, it absolutely does, because, I mean, not only can the Senate actually censure the Dáil, but it can also put forward bills that and issues that wouldn't normally see the light of day in the Dáil. One of those great examples, actually, in terms of current issues, was the 2018 bill on the Occupied Territories, the Occupied Territories bill that put forward by Francis Black, which bans any kind of trade between any of the occupied territories in Gaza and Ireland. Now, that's the kind of thing that would not have seen the light of day in the Dáil. But those are the kind of issues that senators in the Shannon can put forward. They can raise really important social and cultural issues that otherwise would not see the light of day. But, you know, the Dáil, you know, they have to listen to the Senate. They have to listen to that voice. They may, you know, have the power to go ahead and do whatever they want. But remember, also, at the end of the day, our president signs those bills, and what the Senate can make sure that whatever is put forward is essentially constitutional as well, and make sure that you know, we don't have a system where whereby we have TDs running away with themselves and doing whatever they want. I actually think, do you know what, Ireland has probably the best democracy in the world. Well, I when you look at what's going on around us, and we won't mention any countries by name, but you know, you think,
go
you
on.
Know, We have a fantastic democracy here. You know, the whole proportional representation system, I think, is incredibly fair.
Well, we're only two countries, where Malta is the only other country that has that system, isn't it?
Yeah. But now, what I would say to you, Niall, is that the Shannon does need reform.
Yeah.
And we do need to, you know, that's one of the things I would certainly look at. And, you know, for example, this notion of, you know, Trinity being a standalone constituency, this is the last time that will happen, because we're
I was going to say there's changes, because, okay, let's just get to that part, right? People don't understand how you get elected in the Shannon, because it is a little bit more complicated than a general election or local election or whatever it happens to be. It's not the people that vote, essentially. It's the colleges. It's the academics of this country.
Yeah.
So how many people get elected? How many get voted in? And I'm going to mention the other candidates in a few minutes, to be fair, in your constituency, so to speak.
Yeah.
But so how do they get elected?
There's a whole variety of ways of getting elected. I'm on one of the university panels, and Trinity have three seats in the Senate, and the other universities on the NUI, National University of Ireland system, also have three seats. So there's a little bit of an imbalance there, and that's why they're going to merge together for the next time. But also, you know, the Taoiseach can apply, create senators, put people into the Senate. Various organizations like the
political parties can do it as well, can't they? They can put two their candidates.
Can well.
Yeah.
But, you know, somebody wrote to me the other day and said, why can't ordinary people be voted to the Senate? And what I said to him was, actually, anybody can be voted to the Senate. I had to get 10 people to propose me, 10 graduates from Trinity College had to propose me in order for me to stand on the ballot. But the thing about it is, those people proposed me because of my 40 years of advocacy and campaigning for LGBT rights and all of the wonderful things that you mentioned at the start of the show. So I think what we need is extraordinary people representing us in places like the Senate, not ordinary people. You need to have had some sort of background. You need to have really put yourself above the parapet a bit. Mm. But essentially, anybody can run if you can get, if you can be proposed.
No, I do enjoy some of the debates that go on in the Senate, you know, and when I listen to it, you get a good mix and representation of views, be it conservative or liberal or whatever it happens to be. Some of the things they're going to raise, actually, before I do that, I do want to mention, obviously, the university or the other people that are running as well against you, as well as Derek Byrne, there's Abbas Ali O'Shea, there's Kevin Byrne, there's Hazel Chew, Tom Clonan, Leisha De Bruin, Hugo MacNeil, Marcus Matthews, Aubrey McCarthy, John Mulcahy, Paul Mulville, Addy Ulbrud, I hope I'm pronouncing her name right, Saib O'Neill, Lynn Ruan, Oisín Smith, and Catherine Zappone. There's a blast in the past. Catherine Zappone, I didn't think she was even in the country anymore, but there you go. She's back, and she'll be running as well. So they're the kind of, just to give them a mention, that are running against you. What do you think your chances are, by the way? And how many seats are, did you say, in...
There are three seats, and okay. There are two incumbent. Tom Cloran and Lynn Ruan are the incumbent senators. There's an open seat because my great friend and my mentor on this, David, has been giving me great advice. David Norris.
What a wonderful man.
Therefore,
one of the best interviews I've ever done on radio. One of the best interviews I've done on radio was I spent an hour talking to him on radio, and he is hilariously funny as well as being extremely intelligent. What a wonderful, wonderful human being he is.
The story you told me about him listening to the show on the roof in his underwear.
I rang him. I was working in 98FM at the time, many, 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 many years ago, and it was an issue came up or something like that. And I remember I got the producer says, give David a ring there. He'll come on. So he rang him and he went, good evening, lad. Guess where I am? I'm up on the roof of my apartment in my underwear drinking wine. And I went, lovely. He's such a funny guy. He's so down to earth.
Amazing guy. And he's been so kind to me and given me great advice, you know.
Yeah.
And it would be absolute honour to follow him into the challenge.
How is he, by the way? How is David? Is he? I haven't spoken to him in a few months.
I saw him just before Christmas, and I'm in contact with one of his friends who sees him on almost a daily basis, and they say he's doing fine.
He did run into some ill health. I know he's in bad health there for a while, but
I mean, he's just an incredible person. I reminded him once at an event. You know, I said, just remember, Queen Mothers live until they're 101. So you've
okay, but look, the issues you're going to be chatting about or debating if you do get elected will be the obvious. The same as that, you know, even in the general election, they will chat about. And let's just come to them one by one and let's see where you stand on them. Immigration, of course, is one of the, you know, the key issues. I'll come to housing and everything else in a second, but immigration certainly seems to be a key issue around the country at the moment. And it's not going to get any better over the next year, you know, with increasing numbers of people coming to Ireland, the accusations that people are unvetted, et cetera, and all that kind of stuff. Where do you stand on that?
Well, I think, you know, immigration is essential. I grew up in an Ireland which was, you know, hegemonic, and, you know, growing up as a gay man was something that was very difficult. So for me, immigration has been a great asset to Ireland and has helped us to develop socially and culturally and economically. I think the problem we have now, Niall, is that the immigration system has been very, very badly managed. And we've ended up with a system whereby people are genuinely in fear of particularly the number of single men coming into the country.
Mm-hmm.
When you put large numbers of single men in small villages, of course you're going to create atmospheres of mistrust and fear. And we have to listen to people when they express that. I just think it's been very, very badly mismanaged. But what we also have to remember is that over 80% of the illegal immigration coming into Ireland at the moment is coming from down from Northern Ireland. So people coming into Britain and then coming through here. It requires, I think, a much better system of management. And also, one of the things
we need to stop being afraid to deport people. It's okay to deport people, you know, because, you know, if people come to a country illegally with no identification or no passport, firstly, they're breaking the law, because the law clearly states that you must have some form of identification coming into the country. So, but we need not to be afraid of deportation. It's almost like a dirty word.
One of the problems there, Niall, is that you could have somebody in direct provision for 10 years. You know, they've made a life here at this stage, and then they're deported. The system has to be improved so that, that we deal with...
But the system is allowing them to stay here for 10 years because the system is allowing them to appeal after appeal after appeal, and you've got lawyers making a fortune out of it.
But you also have to apply humanity to the situation, you know, mm-hmm. and it's a very difficult balance. When systems fall down, you know, we end up with situations that are very difficult for human beings to actually cope with. So I think anything we do in relation to immigration has to ultimately, at the end of the day, have a basis in humanity.
And there must be rules and regulations, which we seem to lack at the moment. We just don't.
Yeah, well, yeah. And we don't have the resources. We do not have. I mean, look, for example, was it the canals, British canals? They reported that last year they spent nearly, they spent over half a million on those.
Nearly 900,000 just on railings, for God's sake. Crazy. That's not what we spend on tents as well.
Yeah, absolutely. That's ridiculous. And we shouldn't.
Well, it's a reckless spend of taxpayers' money, isn't it?
Yeah. No,
you know what I mean?
And completely avoidable
if you have a proper system in place that deals with it.
It comes down to proper management, and we don't put the resources into managing these systems. And that's why we end up with all the problems. That's why we end up with racism, and we end up with fear in our societies. I mean, in our towns and villages around the country. I mean, it is crazy when you think of it. I remember seeing one report of a village, I can't remember where it was in Ireland, where there was a population of something like 1,500, and 700 men were brought in to stay in a local facility.
Mm.
That kind of situation is what creates the fear.
No, because it changes the whole demographic of the village.
Totally. And also, one of the things about, you know, if you're going to take a small community in rural Ireland, and say, like, use a local hotel to put up, you know, those immigrants. What you're doing is you're affecting the local economy, because tourists are coming to stay in the hotel and to spend on the shops and businesses in that area. So that kind of thinking needs to be applied so that we aren't destroying local communities with, you know, mismanagement of this issue.
I mean, that leads me on then, I suppose, to the next big topic in this country. And it is being compounded by immigration, of course, which is housing and accommodation. It has become completely unaffordable for young people to stay in this country anymore. Because when you have a government who tells us that 420,000 is affordable housing, you know, you need to be Rothschild to be borrowing 420,000. So it's completely unaffordable for people. It's not going to get any better. It doesn't look like it's going to get any better. And you've got a government who are failing miserably to tackle a housing crisis. So where is the answer to that?
You know, the answer to that is political will. This is a politically manufactured situation. I mean, I'm of the generation, you know, I left home at 22 and I got my first flat in Rathmines for £30 a week, pence a week it would have been. And because of that, you know, I was able to have my life and have my independence. I really feel for young people nowadays who, you know, are still living with their parents' home in their 30s. What kind of a life is that for anybody?
Mm-hmm.
I just, you know, it's not going to change anytime soon, but I think let's not beat around the bush. This is a politically manufactured situation. And it's been numerous governments, not one of them can point the finger at the other. They've all had their part to play in it. And it just needs to change.
But it's having a huge knock-on effect. I was talking about last night, we were talking about the population in general last night on the radio. And it's having a huge knock-on effect on the population, because we're now down to 1.5 children per family. You know, gone from 30 years ago where we would have had 4 children in a family. So this is, by the way, well below population replacement level.
Yeah,
and we're seeing this across Europe, not just here in Ireland. Ireland are suffering badly, and so are the UK. And this is being caused by the lack of accommodation and the lack of housing and the lack of affordability and the cost of living and everything else. Because if you've got a young couple who can only afford a one-bedroom apartment or a studio apartment or something like that, they can't have children. You know what I mean? Because there's nowhere for the kids. They don't have a back garden. There's nowhere for the kids to sleep because they can't afford any more than one bedroom. I mean, so it's having a huge knock-on effect on society.
Yeah, and we also have, I think, at this time, more single people, more people living on their own than ever before.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where, you know, the policy to stop building one bedroom or studio apartments, I think, was a really bad one. I mean, overnight you could sort it. Also, there's a wonderful, where I live, just off Cork Street, there's kind of like these communal living things. I think they'd be ideal for younger people to be able to, you know,
like a hub.
buy something or rent something quite cheap. You know, they're rented out mainly to students at exorbitant rates. But these are things that can be done to help young people, to help them get on the ladder or to get, you know, move away out of their parents' home. There are solutions. Like I say, it's just down to political.
There's another problem coming down the road, by the way, that nobody's really been thought about. And I was talking about it yesterday, too. And that is the fact that we're now renting more than we buy. Years ago, everybody owned their own home at some point in their life. Mm-hmm. Now we're renting more than we're buying. So what's going to happen to the pensioners of the future in 10 or 15 years' time when those pensioners who ordinarily would have bought a house and owned their own house before they get to the point where they're claiming a pension, which is 200 and whatever it is euro per week, which means life is affordable. But if they don't own their own home and they're still renting and paying, you know, 1,500 to 2,000 to rent a house, how are they going to do that when they're on a pension? So what are we going to do in 10 years when all those renters who are older haven't got a house? Who's going to pay the rent?
Well, this is where, you know, again, you know, governments don't think way down the line. They don't think 20 years down the line. And that needs to happen. You know, what you find with governments is they tend to look for short results, short-term mm-hmm. results, so that they can talk about them at the next general election and say, look at what we've done.
Yeah, thinking 5 years ahead.
Rather than thinking, you know, investing in long-term solutions. Well, you're absolutely right, and that's something we need to bang on about and make sure that we're talking about. Because what will happen is you'll end up with those rents being subsidised. And again, costing the state a fortune. There just doesn't seem to be any joined up thinking on these issues, you know?
The cost of living, of course, is something that's affecting everybody at the moment, unless you're extremely well off. There's very few of those around, a small percentage of the population. So the cost of living is affecting everybody. The cost of energy, we're almost the highest energy cost in the world. We're the third highest cost of living in Europe. Ireland, not just for accommodation, but for everything, has become unaffordable. And nobody seems to have the political will to do anything about it. We're looking across the water at Donald Trump, right? I know we had to bring up his name at some point. But he is tackling the cost of living by he's abandoning green policies. He's going to drill for oil, make energy cheaper, make gas cheaper, make you know, petrol cheaper and oil cheaper and all those kind of things cheaper. And they're the main things that people purchase. So he at least he's, you know, he's going to put tariffs on other countries who import goods. So at least goods will be made in his own country. So that'll provide jobs and make life cheaper. So he's making an effort. He's a businessman. So why aren't we doing stuff like that? Why aren't we tackling the cost of living? Why are we just allowing it to continue to grow and grow and grow to a point where people literally can't afford to put their heating on the cold nights?
Yeah, well, I think you just said it there. We're allowing it. We're allowing it. Look what we don't protest in this country. I think we put up with an awful lot of absolute crap in this country. But look what we did in terms of the water charges. You know, when we are pushed too far, we will act. I think that we just put up with too much. We don't get out on the streets enough. I mean, look at the French, for example. You know, we should be more like the French.
I think social media has killed protesting, because people go on social media, they rant. They think they've done their bit, and that's it.
I think we were always quite bad at it, because and it goes back to, you know, we're so grateful for what we have. While the cost of
living, are we subservient? Are we a bit subservient in this country?
Yeah, we are, and there's still a bit of an inferiority.
We're kind of just thankful for what we have.
Exactly. You know, but you know, I come as a, you know, again, I go back to as a gay man, I'm used to going out in the streets and protesting and doing all sorts of things, and I love a good march, a good protest. But you know, it's very hard. I mean, to give you an example, myself and Senator Tom Clonan organized 2 years ago a protest outside the Nigerian embassy, protesting about three gay men who were sentenced to stoning by death. We called, you know, I think 30 people turned up with that. Yeah. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Irish people just don't protest. Yeah. Well, I do. We allow too much to go.
You see what happens when we do protest. Now, I don't condone violent protests or anything like that. I mean, I understand sometimes you'll get a level of civil disobedience, and that always happens at a protest. I don't condone the violent aspect of it, but we've seen what happened with protests. The Garda Síochána lately, in the last 5-6 years, they just don't seem to allow protesting. You know, well, I mean,
unfortunately, and you mentioned social media. Part of the issue with social media is that it allows other groups to take over protests or to
incite it.
You know, so that's always a danger. But
the guards know who all that. The guards know who they are. They should just root them out. You know what I mean?
But there are other ways of protesting. I mean, look at the water charges. I didn't pay my water charge.
Yeah, neither did I.
Just don't pay. You know, there are other ways.
I actually did the thing on the air at the time when the water charge bills were coming in. I got into a bit of trouble with the broadcast authority for it. I gave 10 different things you can make out of your bill, and I had, you can make a hat out of it, a corsage, you know. And then I tore it up live on the air, which didn't go down too well. But I tore it up.
I think that was one example of where we were just simply pushed too far. I mean, we are taxed to the hills of this country. So if they can find a way to tax you, they will. And sometimes, I think it generally can be very unfair. I think we need to be much more active and much more vocal in our protesting in this country and not just sit back and take as much as we do.
I mentioned the cost of living. I suppose the next big thing that's going to come up in the Shannon, probably between now and the summer, depending on who gets back in justice, by the way, but it won't be Helen McEntee, most likely. But I have a
A
funny
lovely
feeling.
relationship with Helen McEntee. I think she's great. She's an awful lot on the domestic violence issues, and she supports
Stop.
Trump.
She's not, she's, I mean, you might like her on a personal level, but I mean, she's not popular. Let's be clear about it. I mean,
Oh,
what
well,
didn't
I
do her,
see.
what
I
didn't
don't
do her any
mind that.
favors?
Do you know if you're not popular, you're doing your job?
I
That's
know,
what
yeah, but what didn't do her any
I'll
favors was telling everybody that Dublin was safe while she was walking around flanked by three guards and two photographers. That didn't do her any justice or any good at all, to be
No,
honest with you.
listen,
And the hate
we all
speech
make
bill, which has
mistakes.
come, yeah, it's a bit of a crusade for her, this hate speech bill. Where do you stand on the hate speech bill? Look, we've got the hate crime bill has already gone through. That's fine. Everybody's okay with that to some degree. Although I don't believe personally people should go to jail longer just because the crime happens to be motivated by hate. It doesn't matter. It's a crime is a crime. It's assault. But anyway, on the hate speech bill, I mean, are we not heading down a dangerous road? We voted in a referendum going back 7 years ago to get rid of blasphemy in this country, whereby we couldn't say anything bad about the Catholic Church. Now we can. We can say, well, what would we want, right? Because we voted to get rid of blasphemy. All we're doing is replacing the blasphemy laws with another set of protected characteristics that we can't talk about. So, I mean, do you agree with the hate speech bill?
No. And that's a very quick answer. And because, I, as a journalist, and particularly as somebody who writes opinions, I could be accused of all sorts of things. And I think it's going down a very dodgy path. Now, I've got one of my friends, Adam Long, has been with the National Lesbian Gay Federation, has been very vocal on this and very active on this. And we've had some really good discussions with each other on it. So, what I can say is I have listened to the other side. I just think, no, I think it's problematic. I really do. What I don't, what I would be worried about is who decides what's hate speech? Who makes that
Well, a
decision?
judge, according to Helen McEntee, a judge and a jury are your peers, but you could be waiting a year for that to happen. You've been accused of something because somebody makes an accusation of hate against you. And it might not be hate, it might be just they're pissed off or offended by what you
Listen,
said.
I'd have been locked up years ago. I'd still be locked up if that was it. So no, I don't think there's any place for it. I think, we at the same time, freedom of speech does not mean that you can say whatever you want.
No, there's, well, there's
You
already
have to break.
legislation there. You can't incite violence. You can't incite hatred against the community. You know, there's already legislation there. The guards are very clear, by the way, in relation to the riots last November, that there was individuals who had gone online and encouraged people, you know, to riot or whatever it was, that they used the existing legislation from 1989 to charge those people. So if they could do that, well, then what's the need for
And
it?
what drives me mad as well is, some of the very people are talking about, oh, we need this hate speech bill, are the very same people who said absolutely horrible things about me on social media. So
Probably me too.
I find it absolutely, ridiculous.
Yeah, well, if it comes in, I'm going to charge loads of people because the amount of names I get called on a daily basis on social
I'll be
media.
gone. I will just be locked up and throw
So,
away this.
you're guaranteeing me that if this comes up again, which it will before the summer, I have my fears as to who the next Minister for Justice is, but I'm not going to say it anyway. You're guaranteeing me that you will not be obviously for this. You wouldn't certainly wouldn't be
Couldn't
voting for this.
support it, as I couldn't. My conscience wouldn't. I'd be terrified, to be perfectly honest with you.
Now, where are we going with healthcare? And I don't know whether that's your forte or not, but we now have, well, the cost is going up again. I predict by the end of this year, by the way, we'll be told the children's hospital still won't be ready for another 2 years. Not only the most expensive hospital in the world, we're now looking at it could end up being the most expensive building in the world. I mean, and we still have the numbers the other day growing again, over 1 point something million people waiting for an appointment or waiting for, you know, day wards or whatever it is on the waiting list. I mean, it's just out of control.
It actually is quite complex. The reality is that we have a small population in this country, and we're trying to fund something that we cannot afford. One of the things I would say, I mean, don't start me on that hospital, by the way. I mean, that's just one of the biggest disgraces of our government's
In the
successive
history of the
government.
state, it has to be the most
It's
expensive
just
thing we've ever done, yeah.
beyond.
And no transparency, no accountability. Well, okay, the only accountability was, of course, that Stephen Donnelly wasn't re-elected, but that's not really accountability, is it?
Well, there no. Well, it's a clear message. That's the thing. It's a clear message. But the thing is that What I find, I can only go on my personal experience. What I have found in terms of healthcare in Ireland is that when you're in the system, it works very well. And I think a lot of people have said that to me as well. But like you say, it's the waiting list is the problem. But the care that's given here in Ireland in general is quite good, and the system works fairly well once you're in it. But affording it is another thing. But I mean, I'm one of those people that every time I go to see a doctor, it costs me at least 100 euro, 65 euro to see the doctor, and 35 for prescription. That, and there have been times, I mean, I'm very lucky, there've been times when maybe it's the time of the month where I wouldn't have 100 euro, and I'd say to my doctor, listen, I'm not going to be paid until next week, can
Can
I
I put
come
it on a
down? And he'd say, yeah,
tick?
sure, no problem. But not everybody has that. So actually the cost does put people off getting proper care, and that's just not on. I think that
I mean,
I've just like
we've seen an increase in cancer diagnosis in Ireland, massive increase in cancer diagnosis. Now, a lot of that is, by the way, good due to good detection, right? And early
Yeah, that's
detection
early
rates.
diagnosis,
Yeah,
which is great.
absolutely. Absolutely. But the thing about it is, a lot of those people might have been caught even earlier if they could afford to go to a doctor earlier, if they had to get an appointment earlier. During COVID, I won't get into that, whether they didn't get an appointment at all. A lot of those people are quite sick. But, we're not, like, when we feel something wrong with us, we're putting it off because of the cost of 60 quid or whatever it is, or whatever your doctor charges,
You're
65 or 100
dead
quid.
right.
So we're
You're
putting it
dead right.
off. Asher, I'll be
It
grand.
shouldn't be, it should not, cost should never be a barrier to healthcare for an individual, ever, ever, ever. So doctors need to kind of work with their patients, like mine does. I have to say they're great, they're lovely people, and they look after me well. But like that, yeah, there have been times where I didn't have the 65 euro, and they'll say, yeah, come down and pay us next week when you get paid. But yeah, like I say, cost should never be an issue for accessing healthcare when you need it.
So what's the solution? We can't go down the road of the NHS because we wouldn't have the money to do it, which is, free healthcare, free GP care for people. That's ideally what we need, isn't it? With
I think we need to
administration
get.
costs, maybe, just to stop people wasting time. But and by the way, I've always said that medical cards should have an administration fee, particularly for GP practices, of a fiver or even, just to stop people wasting time.
See, also, yeah, that's the problem. You do have people clogging up the system who don't need to be there, and so it's not just a one solution problem. We need to look at a lot. I mean, I know of situations where people with medical cards will go to the doctor for the slightest thing. Some
Oh,
people don't
sniffle.
can. And I mean, those of us who pay 65 euro tend to kind of like, your leg has to be falling off before you ring the doctor. But it's neither are ideal situations. We need to find a proper balance, and that takes time and education and
Okay.
cultural change.
Moving on to something you've been working on for many, many years, and something which I think is probably your speciality as such, which is domestic violence. Both in men and women, because I know you're very representative of men as well. Do you feel we're tackling as well when it comes primarily to men? I know we're making great efforts and great headway when it comes to women, but do you think we're ignoring men?
Yeah, well, that's the area I work in, is male domestic men who are victims of domestic violence and the coercive control, specializing in the LGBT perspective. Domestic violence is one of those issues that is very difficult for us to address in this country because of the stigma and shame that is still attached to it. I mean, you just have to look at the figures. They speak for themselves. Also, sexual violence is huge in this country.
What are the figures? Because I remember some
Well,
time ago, it was Gerry Adams. I said, I think it was Micheál Martin. He asked, he said, what are the figures for male domestic violence in Ireland? And Micheál Martin said he didn't know. This has gone back about 10 years ago. And Gerry Adams turned around and says, you know why you don't know? He said, because we don't have the figures, because nobody's ever bothered to check. Now, I'm sure since then, maybe people have. But to me, I remember reading an article once that 4 in every 9 cases are male, right? Now, I don't know if that's true or not. 4 in every 9 cases. And they said that's based on the fact that men tend not to report it. So it's a slight exaggeration of the figure. So what is the figure?
Well, you see, people tend to not report. Most women won't report. The figures that we would have in my job, we would have supported almost 8,000 men last year. But about 95% of men who are victims of domestic violence just don't report it because they don't think anyone will believe them. But and how do we know that's 95%? Well, that's because we discover other people through things like accident and emergency departments, through so other social care systems. We discovered that some of the issues that present in other areas are related to domestic violence, and that's for men and women and for members of the LGBT community. So what my role is in education, and a wonderful woman I work with, who works with us, from Trinity College, whose name, Professor Corbley, her first name's gone out of my head for some reason, but she stated recently that we have to educate people first, because most people don't know that they're experiencing domestic violence. They don't understand that they're in abusive
Because it's
relationships.
the norm. It's become the norm for them.
I do a lot of work with younger people, for example, in helping them to understand what is and what isn't a good and a bad relationship. What is their sense of value? I mean, the definition, for example, of sexual violence is anything which violates your sense of personal dignity. How do you know it's been violated if you don't have an awareness of your personal dignity? We have to start teaching that in schools. People have to become more aware of what acceptable behavior is and isn't in an intimate relationship or in a family relationship. Domestic violence can happen with anybody in the home. Intimate partner violence is specifically just between you and your intimate partner, your significant other. But the big issue is that most people don't know that they're in abusive relationships. And then when they do discover that, where do they go for help? They're afraid to report to the Gardaí.
Are the Gardaí
I
any
think
better at dealing with it? Because I had a mate of mine going back a couple of years ago there, and his wife was giving him a hard time, giving him the odd box every now and again. And they were going through a divorce separation or something at the time. So he was still living in the house, because that's the way it is nowadays, because people can't afford to move out. So they just live separate lives in the same house. Anyway, he went down to the guards to report her. And the guard's answer to him was, have you thought about moving out? Now, that's not an answer. You know what I mean? I can guarantee if the roles were reversed and the woman had gone down and said, look, my husband's giving me a hiding every now and again, they would have dealt with it very differently. So are the guards, are they being trained properly to understand and recognise it and deal with it properly, particularly if it's male?
I do a lot of, about a third of the work I do is with the guards and Garda Síochána, and I do, I work with some amazing guards. I think, there's a realization that they are lacking in training on this area, and that it needs to improve. And I'm working very closely with senior members of the guards to try to make sure that happens. But it's a huge issue. And the problem is that it's also very complex. What I always say, though, to in the training I do with the guards, they sort of say to me things like, if I get called out to a same-sex relationship, I don't know what to be saying. I'm afraid I'm going to say the wrong thing. I'm going to do the wrong thing, whatever. Or if it's a man, optically, he could be 6 foot 2 and she's 5 foot 6. Optically, it doesn't look right. I always say, look, at the end of the day, you have to be authentic. You have to really want to help those people. And anybody in crisis, if anybody calls the guards, they are in crisis. What they really want is to feel that when a guard arrives, or anybody that they've approached for support, genuinely wants to help them. So you start with that authentic compassion. And once you've got that, you've made one step in the right direction, but it does require specialist training. And again, one of the greatest comments I had working with some very senior guards a few years ago was, particularly when I did some work on the LGBT perspective, and talking about the overall male perspective, was that they thought, we thought you'd just apply the same thing to every situation. And that's what they learned, that it's not a case of one size fits all, that you have to learn about the complexities of domestic violence from various minority perspectives in order to be able to respond to it properly. That's the kind of training I do. It's the kind of training that is needed. This word intersectionality has become so important in everything we do now. Understanding diversity, understanding where the power is in our society, where the disadvantage is in our society, because at the end of the day, domestic violence is all about power and control.
Well, look, Derek, I know when it comes, certainly when it comes to domestic violence, there's nobody better than you, I tell you, because I've spoken to you many times throughout the years talking about domestic violence and LGBT issues as well. But on everything else, I'm sure some people will agree with your opinions, others will disagree.
You have no messages for men.
But by the way, that's another thing. I mean, even helplines, for example, you look at a phone book, well, we don't have phone books anymore, but you can look online and find a million numbers if you're a woman. And I don't mean this in a bad way, because they should be there. Absolutely. But in saying that, but if you're a man, really, there isn't. There's one. I off the top of my head, I don't even know of one, but I'm assuming there is more. You could probably bring the Samaritans and other people as well if you wanted to. But there is Men's Aid, and that's all I'm aware of. Is there any other ones?
The Men's Network as well is another.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Well,
you're absolutely right.
But even Men's Refuge, there are women's refuges all over the place. But there aren't men, and so many men end up homeless on the street. The majority of people homeless on the street are men. And a lot of them come from broken marriages, et cetera, you know, where they've literally nowhere to live. I mean, there's a lot of men who are living in a situation where they should probably be separated or divorced, but they know they have nowhere to go. And if they break up the marriage, they'll end up homeless.
They can't. This is the thing. A lot of men end up staying in abusive relationships because they can't afford to move out. But also, what I find, it breaks my heart sometimes, is that you'll hear men staying in relationships because their female partner is physically violent to them. They're afraid if they leave, that physical violence will turn towards the children. So they stay as a kind of a buffer to keep the children safe. I mean, that's just...
Yeah. And we have to make it clear, women can be equally as violent as men. I mean, this whole idea that women... And psychologically as well.
It's a human issue. Yeah. That's where I stand on it. It's a human issue, and we have to approach it as a human issue.
Well, look, Derek, the best of luck. Wednesday the 29th. Well, after the 29th, you'll find out. You'll find out your faith. Are you feeling positive, and are you looking forward to the challenge?
You know what? I have loved this process. I've absolutely had a wonderful time. I'm overwhelmed by the support that's coming my way. And you know, people like yourself as well, you know, have been a great support. For me, I've won already. I've had a great experience. I think win, lose, or draw, this is going to be very good for me and for the issues like domestic violence that, you know, I want to continue working with. And so as far as I'm concerned, this has been amazing, and I'm really happy with how it's all going. But you know, my chances are actually quite good. Chances are good.
Okay, well, look, I did mention all the other candidates as well. You can vote for any of them as well if you wanted to. But Derek Burness, thank you very much indeed for joining us this evening, and we appreciate it, and good luck.
Thanks, Noel. Thanks a million.